My name is Gail McCray. I'm a nurse, RN-BSN. I worked in the Bay Area of California. I was in graduate school. I finished that program, but was unable to complete the clinical hours required to graduate because I refused to take the COVID shot. And I would add, in addition to that, I had confirmed natural immunity, which I presented to my employer and my school, and both chose to dismiss that fact of science that was well established for hundreds of years.
How long have you been a nurse?
Yeah, so I graduated from nursing school in 2011. I worked in acute care for about 3 years in the Bay Area of California. And then it was my dream to become a certified nurse midwife and a nurse practitioner. More than anything, I wanted to start a private practice. So in route to that, I ended up moving to Africa and working in the rural Serengeti district of Tanzania for a year at a district hospital there delivering babies. And that was crazy. I contribute a lot of my toughness to that experience, because when you're working in the middle of a third world country with no support, I didn't go in with a team. It was me and my husband in the middle of a third world country, a couple of white people surrounded by like tribal, you know, it was tribal. 100% of the population of the girls that I was caring for in the labor and delivery department were generally genital mutilated. So
90%?
Closer to 100. Those types of experiences really hit hard as far as, you know, coming from a Western culture and, you know, being educated in California. I was, you know, even the toughest of backgrounds in a place like this, you really see the rubber hit the road when you work in a third world culture like that. So that really changed my perspective of medicine in a lot of ways. It really taught me about what I should and shouldn't be afraid of. When it really comes down to it, working in those kinds of conditions really helped me to understand, you know, an influenza type viral infection with a 99.5 to 9% survival rate. It's really something that, as a practitioner, I was very familiar with dealing with. And so it really put things in perspective, and it helped me to control the power that the fear-mongering that I saw coming through on the media at the beginning of COVID. It really helped me keep that stuff in perspective, because I'd really been there and done that. So, yeah.
So in short, it wasn't a big deal, or?
Well, I would actually say that it was the opposite of a big deal when it started. In 2020, we shut down our communities in March of that year, and the hospitals stopped scheduling elective surgeries. So the hospital actually totally emptied out. And we were actually getting canceled because there were so few patients. So that was a huge red flag to me when I was seeing on the media that the hospitals were full. And I was getting, when I go to work, the hospital was empty. They had the like white tent set up outside, you know, that all of the nurses talk about. They set up these tents, they paid all this money to have all these extra supplies, and they literally sat empty for the entirety of COVID. That was crazy because, you know,
this is in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And do you have any indication that was the same way across the country?
Yes, I do have indications for sure that it was that way throughout the state of California. I stayed in contact with a majority of my classmates from the East Bay, and most of them ended up working throughout the state. So I have friends in Sacramento area. I had nurses practicing all over the Bay Area, and then many down in Southern California as well. Friends in Fresno, all over the state of California, and they were reporting the same thing.
The empty hospitals, but these tents outside them.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's more of a publicity stunt?
It was really actually pretty disturbing, because it was just hyping up the fear in the community, and it wasn't grounded in fact. When you talk so fearfully about a virus and that it's deadly and lethal and you're going to die from it, and if you go to the hospital, like, you're, you know, your families are going to die, you're going to infect grandma and she's going to die. I mean, the psychosocial impacts of that are very serious. And that was something that I saw at the beginning as being extremely disturbing. Yeah, so after we started canceling elective surgeries and the hospital emptied out, they remained empty for the whole first year of COVID. I was getting canceled because the hospital was so there were no patients. And I was in graduate school at the time. I was working on a double master's as a nurse practitioner and a women's health nurse practitioner, a certified nurse midwife. That was a big part of that, the COVID experience for me, is that I was really immersed in the research. And I discovered very early on that the research wasn't being properly represented by the media. For instance, the Pfizer clinical trials data, they said in the conclusion of that paper that the Pfizer shots were safe and effective. But when you actually go into the meat of the research, the control group had lower all-cause death rates than the vaccinated group, and they didn't really get into why. So there's holes. That was one thing I noticed right off the bat, being in graduate school, working in the hospital on the COVID floors, and being immersed in the research, is that there were massive holes in what they were presenting to the public. The information was not fully, they were leaving out big chunks of the research. They weren't effectively representing the truth about what was happening in the research. And they were intentionally scaring people when in fact the hospitals were empty. A little more background. I'd been a nurse for 10 years. I owned a home or two or three in Sonoma County. And my husband worked full time as a civil engineer. We had a couple little kids. I mean, I was literally like your ideal example of like a standard American. And so when I started seeing these red flags with COVID, it was really, I couldn't believe it. And that was really my delay in speaking out, is that I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't believe that the media would lie and manipulate the public. I couldn't believe that these hospital protocols were being pushed, because every single thing about them defied the oath I took as a practitioner. So the protocols, first and foremost, they told people that if they got sick with COVID, they should just go home and self-isolate and do nothing. Okay, in the 10 years, and then plus the 5-7 years of education I'd had, that had never been an option. You don't ever tell a patient to go home and do nothing. That's not practicing medicine. That's fear. That's like spreading fear. I mean, that's what that did, is it made people more afraid. Instead of empowering them with something simple like, hey, you know, go take some vitamin D and zinc. Like, that would have helped to soothe the fear, and it would have helped support reduction in hospital admissions, because we saw right out the gate that vitamin D deficiency was the number one factor for patients being admitted to the hospital, was having vitamin D deficiency. So that was one of the early on protocols that I felt violated my oath and my license, was by telling people to go home and do nothing. That's never an option. A practitioner should never say that to a patient.
Why is that?
So there's two parts of it. There's the psychosocial aspect of making them feel hopeless and hopeless. And then there's the physiological and scientific aspect of like, well, of course you can do something. We've always known that vitamin C, vitamin D, and zinc support, a shorter recovery time in illness and disease. So why is it that we wouldn't somehow apply that in this situation? I mean, especially with a novel virus. I mean, if it was in fact novel, of course you would want to give patients every first option to treat that you possibly could, not tell them to go home and hide. So that was the first, that was one of the first medical things that I watched happen that was extremely disturbing. And then when it came to hospital admissions, that was just a complete disaster.
So could you walk me through this then? So the hospitals are basically shut down, everything's canceled, and then it's just COVID patients, right?
Well, anyone who needed to be admitted to the hospital. So it's not necessarily COVID. It's any reason you would need to be admitted, just not elective.
I'm just trying to dive into the financials of like, well, they shut off a lot of the hospital's revenue streams, and then they added these PIFs or perks.
Yes.
For COVID things. So did you observe any of that? Financial incentives to treat patients?
I observed charts and death records being documented as COVID when they weren't. Yes. And why would they do that? I can't really speculate. I could, but it would be speculation. Yes, I have discovered since then that there is incentivization going on. There's massive payouts, and that almost definitely plays a role in why we were being told to document these deaths and these admissions as COVID when they weren't. The PCR test was a huge scandal from the get-go. I mean,
so everyone coming in the hospital had to take a PCR test?
Every person coming in had to take a PCR test. And the PCR tests weren't being properly evaluated by the lab. So there's the cycle thresholds. I mean, even the designer of the PCR test said PCR tests aren't designed as a diagnostic tool. And not only were we using them as a diagnostic tool, we were not supporting those diagnoses with signs and symptoms. So that's a big no-no in diagnostics. Like, if you have a diagnostic test, you must support it with signs and symptoms. And that was not the case with COVID diagnoses. All you had to do to get a positive diagnosis for COVID was have a positive PCR test, which that's not scientifically based medicine. So, diagnostic tests are routinely inaccurate. They're either false positives or false negatives. That's known throughout science. Every single diagnostic test has its own variation of errors on one side or the other. The point is they are routinely not necessarily accurate. So in order to address that, doctors have put in place protocols requiring that in addition to a positive diagnostic test, you must have signs and symptoms to correlate with that diagnostic test because of the error rates in diagnostic tests. So signs and symptoms for COVID would be like, you know, severe headache, fever, chills, cough, congestion in the lungs. So patients were being diagnosed with COVID based strictly on a positive PCR test without correlating signs and symptoms, which technically is required by any practitioner when making a diagnosis. The requirement is you must have signs and symptoms in addition to a positive diagnostic test. You can't have one or the other, you must have both. That's what creates a diagnosis. So when you're lacking, so that's what we did in COVID. We just took PCR tests. We didn't correlate them with signs and symptoms. And so we created the false illusion of having, you know, high rates of COVID tests, positive tests in the community, but they weren't being substantiated by signs and symptoms. So they were in fact like overinflated numbers is what I'm getting down to. Also, I had a conversation with the California health officer. They would go online and do meetings once a month for the health to update the community on the status of COVID. One of my colleagues directly asked the California health officer if when a person went in to take a PCR test, three times in the same week to show that they had COVID, and all three tests came back positive, she confirmed that that actually hit the statistics as three different COVID positive patients. So that's another way we were hyperinflating the numbers, is that every single test that was taken, regardless of if it was the same person in the same week, they were counted as a separate COVID positive case. So that added to the fear and the inflation of numbers and all of the things that were causing distress in the community when it wasn't grounded.
And to your knowledge, that was going on nationwide?
Yes.
Globally?
It was absolutely going on in the state of California. I would speculate that it was nationwide, if not global. The next thing that happened was the isolation of patients from their family members. So I was trained in nursing school. We actually read through studies that showed that patients who were isolated when they were sick had a significantly higher risk of dying because of the social isolation. It's a known thing in science that you don't isolate people. That's why we have the brig in prison. That's a form of torture. You isolate people to torture them. So when they started saying that we needed to isolate our patients and not allow a support system, that was another really big red flag to me because of my background in education. There's no justification to isolate a patient who's afraid for their life. One of the things that kept coming up for me was like, okay, so I'm a nurse. I'm going to work. I'm taking care of my patients. I'm taking precautions. And then I'm going home to be with my family. And I did that every day. So how is it that I can do things like, you know, have precautions to be at the hospital and the family members can't? What's the difference there? And, you know, people try to say, well, they're not essential. I argue that on moral grounds, they are essential. It is essential for the well-being of a patient to have their support system and their family members holding their hands when they're afraid for their life. And I would argue that a majority of the COVID deaths, a major contributing factor was the isolation. And that was one of the biggest hits for me when I had to start telling family members that they couldn't come to the bedside of their dying loved ones. That drove me away from medicine in a big way. It broke my heart. I watched my family, my patients' family members, their hearts break. I watched my patients decline. It was criminal. It should have never happened. If we can protect ourselves and go home to our families, so can the family members who need to be there to support their loved ones. That was a really huge violation of human ethics, human rights violations that caused massive death in the hospital.
It seemed like a lot of things were being pushed on these patients, protocols and isolation and all these things that that a lot of the family and the patients and the family sort of just went along with.
The medical protocols that were being implemented during COVID were a violation of patients' rights. They were being bullied into accepting the protocols because they were being told that they didn't have another option. The truth of the matter is that these organizations like the CDC that set protocols, you know, the hospitals and the doctors are licensed by these licensing organizations. And part of their stipulation is that they have to go along with CDC protocols. My nursing license, I'm licensed by the BRN. And in order to maintain that license, I have to follow the rules and regulations of that licensing board. And a lot of those rules and regulations tie back to organizations like the CDC, the AMA, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. There's these organizations that set standards of medical protocol that we as practitioners are required to follow in order to maintain a license. If we go against those protocols, we'll have our licenses revoked. So for instance, if the hospitals didn't follow the CDC protocol, they would revoke their Medicare and Medi-Cal and Medicaid funding. It's the primary method of payment for hospitals. If the doctors didn't follow the COVID protocol, which included remdesivir, their license would become under review. I can tell you dozens of doctors I know who had their licenses reviewed and a few who had their licenses revoked for not following COVID protocols. So ultimately, we had our hands tied. And even if we didn't agree with those protocols, which unfortunately, I have to say, I'm very ashamed how many doctors and practitioners went along with these protocols when they could tell that they weren't helping. I could tell you for a fact, within the first month of the administration of remdesivir to my patients, the nurses were sitting around the nurse's station on every unit in my hospital talking about how remdesivir did not work. We were noting that patients were recovering from acute COVID, and they were going into renal and respiratory failure and dying of secondary causes.
That's kidney failure.
Kidney failure. Kidney failure and lungs, and the lungs filling with fluid and failing.
So what is remdesivir? And explain what happened with this.
So remdesivir was the only medication that we were allowed to administer for patients who were hospitalized with COVID. It was an experimental use authorization medication, which means it wasn't fully licensed, which made it extremely expensive. Each dose of remdesivir, I believe, was somewhere around $3,500, and patients needed to receive, were required by the protocols to receive 5 doses of that medication if they were hospitalized for COVID. So they would come in, they would get their first dose in the ER, and then we'd start seeing their kidneys fail. So that was one of the first signs to me that was so unusual, is that we'd never seen a viral infection cause renal failure before. And now all of a sudden we have these patients going into renal failure. It was very peculiar. I definitely didn't directly correlate that to remdesivir at first, because I wasn't really educated on remdesivir when we first started using it. I could tell that it wasn't working. I knew that it was an antiviral, and that in the practice of medicine, every practitioner is taught not to administer an antiviral more than 3 days post-symptom onset, because at that point, the risks outweigh the benefits. And so that was another big red flag, is that I was questioning, why are we administering an antiviral to these patients? Most of them were 10 days plus post-symptom onset. So there was no indication to be using an antiviral. And we also saw in their labs massive inflammation. And that value is called a CRP, C-reactive protein. It shows massive systemic inflammation. And it leads to what you probably have heard on the media, cytokine storm. And untreated massive inflammation leads to cytokine storm. So what we were doing is we were giving people remdesivir, which was an antiviral, more than 3 days post-symptom onset, so there was no indication to give it in the first place. It was causing harm. We were noticing it and talking about it at the nurse's station. And on top of that, we were not treating people for their inflammation. We were giving them like a low dose of solumedrol, which is not the correct steroid to be used for patients. When back in March of 2020, the intensivists indicated that we should be giving very high doses of steroids because we were seeing such massive inflammation, which was not common in most viral infections. That was the distinguishing quality between COVID and the standard infection.
Do you want to sum it up? Like, can you summarize the whole remdesivir saga?
Yeah, remdesivir should have never been given. It was an antiviral. It should never have been given to patients who were more than 3 days post-symptom onset. It was an experimental medication. So even if it was given, people should have been educated on the benefits and risks with that medication, because it's an experimental use authorization product. We don't have long-term data on that medication. So there was a major lack in education to the patients and family members with the use of that product. And it was a tragedy. This is how our doctors' hands were tied. They were being, if the doctors prescribed hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, their license would become under review.
And they cost like 50 cents.
They cost 50 cents or less per treatment. Not
versus
only
$3,500
that,
per treatment.
Ivermectin has one of the most profound safety ratings of any medication that's ever been administered. And they totally framed it as being this horse medicine. Are you kidding me? That medication was discovered in the late 1960s by a Japanese doctor. He won a Nobel Prize for the profound impacts on medicine that medication has made. It had changed the world of medicine. And then the media and the CDC, these organizations, tried to discredit that medication in light of an experimental use authorization product that was $3,500 treatment. The remdesivir clinical trial data from 2014 and 15, there were two trials. One of them showed that there were 53% death rate in the remdesivir group. The second clinical trial with remdesivir, they actually pulled that medication from the trial because the death rates were so high. So we have one study with 53% dead. We have another study that the medication was pulled from because it was so dangerous. And then we have it released as an experimental use authorization while we're talking about how insane hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were when they had been established as safe and effective medications for 35 years. It was outrageous.
And this is a Gilead Gates-funded product, right?
Yes, it was. Gates, Fauci holds the patent on remdesivir. Yeah.
So is that a conflict of interest, you think?
I would say that was extraordinary. I can't make sense of how any government organization could actively choose to not acknowledge the fact that Fauci, the lead health officer making decisions for this country, holds the patent on the only medication that I am allowed to administer to patients hospitalized with COVID. We didn't have another choice. All we could do was give them his medication that had a 53% death rate.
That's crazy.
After the COVID protocols and I started seeing that the hospital system was just, there was something going on that was incredibly shady. And I was feeling more and more so like I needed to escape, because it was my morals. Like I have an oath. You know, I went into medicine to protect people and to help people. And I found myself in a position where I was causing direct harm. I would classify what we were doing for COVID as medical murder. I more and more come to that conclusion every day that those protocols, every single thing that we did, caused harm. And there was no sense to any of it. Why weren't we administering higher doses of steroids? Why weren't we using reliable and safe medications? Why weren't we giving early treatments? None of these things make sense. So this is really what led me to start to think about how am I going to engage in the world around me when I'm witnessing all of these horrifying things happening. And then the shots came out. So these vaccines, these COVID vaccines, it was extraordinary what I saw. So I was working in the Bay Area of California, where we had one of the most compliant populations in the country. And in addition to that, we had a really healthy population. We had lower obesity rates and, lower NICU admissions, lower fetal deaths, lower maternal deaths. All around, we had a generally healthy population, which is why I would say, you know, we didn't have too many people die from COVID. But then when these shots came out, so like I had mentioned, the winter of 2020 and 2021, it was a normal winter. We'd had two hospital fill-ups, spikes in hospital admissions, which was normal. That happens every winter. So it was not outside of the normal. And then the injections released to our public in late February or early March of 2020. And it was like night and day. Within 2 weeks of the rollout of those shots to the public, I started getting calls from my staffing department. In the hospital setting, you know, it's like you're scheduled to work, but if the hospital's slow, they'll cancel you. You can request to be canceled, or they can call you and say, hey, we don't have any patients. Like, do you want to stay home for today? And I was in graduate school, so I was like, yeah, I'll stay home and study. And then, but then when the hospital fills and you're not scheduled and they need staff, they call. They're like, call every single person on the list. They're like, hey, we need extra nurses. Can you come in and work an extra shift? So I was getting calls from the staffing department to come in 3 to 4 times a day. So my manager approached me in June. And I was sitting at the nurse's station and he approached me, the poor guy, he was pale and like sweating and just clearly extremely stressed out. I would bet you that that poor guy hadn't had a day off in 3 months. And he approached me in June and he said, Gail, I don't know what to do. This hospital has had 3 times higher admissions than they've ever had since the hospital opened their doors. And that started in March with the rollout of the COVID shot.
So what conditions were they coming into the hospital with?
Oh, it was extraordinary. It was easy to overlook what was happening when I was only taking care of like 5 patients a shift, because, you know, I would come in, I'd get report on 5 patients, and then I would take care of those patients and then go home. But that's not what I did. So because of my position as a per diem nurse, I would come in and fill in. So what would often happen is I would end up being an extra set of hands throughout the hospital. So on multiple occasions, I went to work and filled the position called a patient care coordinator, where I would get report on every patient in that whole unit. So I would get report on upwards of 30 to 35 people on that shift. And there was one shift in particular where I went to 2 units. I was working a double that day. So I got report on 35 patients in one unit, and then I went to another unit and got report on 35 more patients.
And what were you observing?
Every single patient was there with either heart attack, stroke, pulmonary embolism, the weirdest peripheral clotting disorders I'd ever heard of. In a 3-week period of time, I got report on 4 patients with Guillain-Barré. I've been a nurse at this point for 10 years. In my entire career, I'd taken care of 2 patients with Guillain-Barré. In a 3-week period of time, 4 patients with Guillain-Barré. 2 of those patients, I was able to ask them directly, hey, why did this happen? What caused this rapid onset of Guillain-Barré? 2 of those 4 patients told me directly that they thought that it was caused by the shot and that they were concerned because their doctors wouldn't admit that that's what it was and they wouldn't document it. So that was one experience of my ability to see that there were massive injuries and side effects from these shots that doctors were unwilling to document as vaccine side effects, despite what the patients told them and despite their own experiences. You know, if the patient had this vaccine and then, you know, 8 to 36 hours later, they developed a side effect. I mean, in a rational society, one would think that we would have a discussion about whether this experimental shot could be correlated with this injury. And the fact of the matter is that those side effects, not only were they being denied, they were being covered up. In the hospital, in acute care, we have an overhead system to call out needs for the hospital. It's primarily used to notify the hospital of codes. A code is called, for instance, there are multiple types of codes, but the most common one that we hear is a code blue. And a code blue is called when a patient either stops breathing or their heart stops. It's considered the highest emergency situation. And the reason we call those is to get primary staff members to that bedside as quickly as possible so that we can start resuscitation. So in the 10 years that I worked in the hospital setting, I on average heard one code blue per shift in those full 10 years. And within about a month of the rollout of the COVID injections, and not before then, there was no increase in code blues when COVID entered our communities. It started in direct correlation to the onset of the shots. And not only did I go from hearing one code blue per shift to on average between 6 to 10 code blues per shift, they call in the overhead comm system where that code blue occurs. And 9 out of 10 times, those code blues were occurring on the lower level of the hospital in the clinic where we were administering the COVID vaccines. So on a standard shift, I'd hear code blue, second floor, room 256. And that's what that was broadcasted throughout the whole hospital. After these shots, it was code blue, lower level, injection clinic. And that would happen between 6 and 10 times a day. So in addition to that,
That's crazy. So you're just hearing that over the intercom, injection clinic.
All day. Injection clinic. All day. In addition to that, I had two colleagues that went into anaphylactic shock after receiving the COVID injection. So I do know that it was causing significant harm. And it's not just a speculation. There were undisputable factual occurrences that I was experiencing. Not only did we have the patient population who were directly telling me, I just got this COVID vaccine. Do you think this could be the cause of my adverse event? And I would say to them, I do. And I think that we should document it. And unfortunately, whenever we went to try to discuss documentation of adverse events with both the doctors and the administrative staff of the hospital, we were being pressured not to report. I heard multiple times, especially from the doctors, but also from the administrators, their excuse would be, well, we're not going to report these because we can't prove that this was caused by the vaccine. The fact of the matter is that as a practitioner, we are trained to report potential adverse side effects to the VAERS system. It's not meant to be a factual report of, yes, there's no disputing this was caused by the vaccine. It's meant to sound the alarm so that investigators can go back and determine whether or not it could have possibly been from the vaccines. Once I saw what they were doing to people, that was it for me. So we saw the threefold increase in hospitalizations and deaths directly associated to the onset of these shots. I had a colleague, she manned the injection clinic. She was told by her direct manager that if she reported a single adverse event to these COVID shots, that she would be fired. That's the truth. You know, people sit there and try and talk to me about, oh, you're making, I'm like, no, I'm not. I just have the courage to come forward and talk about this when nobody else does, because they're afraid to lose their jobs. They're afraid of their reputations getting smashed. You know, they're afraid of being labeled as a conspiracy theorist and a spreader of misinformation. But what am I getting out of this? That's what I want people to address. What am I getting out of coming forward and talking about things that people don't want to hear about. Okay. I was fired from my job. I was taken out of my graduate program after I'd finished the degree. They wouldn't let me finish my 700 clinical hours to get my graduate degree and become a primary care provider. And I've been ostracized.
Because you came forward or what?
Because I've come forward and I'm speaking about things that people don't want to hear about. I've been labeled as a conspiracy theorist. And why would I do that? I need people to really answer that question. Like, why would I do that? Like, what am I, like, you know, it's like people are like, oh, like, maybe you have some kind of hero complex. I'm like, no. Like, how does that make sense, right? Like,
what would you say to timid people then?
What I would say to people is that there are several things. There are the fact that I had lived in Africa and I'd learned what to be afraid of. I had been homeschooled when I was in high school. And I think that that really plays a key role because at that period in my life, I was forced to base my own value and self-worth on my own identity of who I was as an individual rather than the collective of the students that I was surrounded by. And it changes the way you engage with the world around you. So when I was in the hospital during COVID, I saw my colleagues and it felt like we were back in high school because I watched them make decisions to compromise their integrity because that's what they were being told to do, because that's what their colleagues were doing. And I wasn't as susceptible to that. And I would argue that the reason for that is because I had learned to develop that sense of self-worth as an individual rather than being reliant on my colleagues. I didn't care what my colleagues thought of me. And that still rings true true today, is that I don't, you know, regardless of what people think of me, I don't rely on their evaluations of me to feel like I'm a decent human being. I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do. Because if I don't say something, I am participating in medical murder. And that's not something I'm willing to do. Some people are willing. I've found that my colleagues are willing to compromise their integrity and ethics to fit in. And I would say to them, at the end of the day, and when you look back on your life, what are you really going to have to show for yourself? I look at my children and I know that I'm making the right decision because I'm teaching them how to act ethically and how to stand up and do what's right, even when it's difficult. And those are invaluable lessons that my children will take with them, not just through this lifetime, but they'll pass on to their own children. It's important.
Great. And I guess one final question. Where are we at with medicine? I think you kind of answered it, but what is the state of the medical system broken?
I could never go back to the medical field. After what I've witnessed, the amount of injuries from these shots, the way that they were being forced, the way that people just went along with it and tried to alienate and discriminate people for trying to not take these shots. There's no ethics left in the medical field. My personal view is that what must happen is we need to separate from this system, turn and rebuild. And when we rebuild, we need to focus on a wellness system rather than an illness system, because the way that medicine is currently run is, you know, patients come in with a symptom and a doctor just hands them a medication without getting down to the root cause. So if we can't discover the root cause of an illness or injury, how are we going to actually help that person in the long run? We're not. We're masking, we're putting a band-aid on a festering wound. It's not going to solve the problem. So My vision is to create a new healthcare system that focuses on wellness, and it focuses on getting down to the root cause of problems. We shouldn't be using medications except for as a last resort. You know, people need to start treating themselves with lifestyle modifications and, you know, living healthfully instead of, you know, continuing to eat garbage and, you know, sit in front of screens. We have to get back to, you know, healthy community-based living.
You have another point to make?
One of the things that happened pretty early on is I became affiliated with a group of practitioners in Sonoma County and throughout the state of California. And one of the ladies in that group was a doctor from the South Bay in California. She and I had multiple discussions about the medical murder occurring in her facility. But she was a refugee from communist China. And it was really eye-opening for me to have a conversation with a practitioner who had firsthand experience with what it looks like to be a part of a totalitarian top-down structure of communist government. And she looked at me in the face. This was just before I was fired. And she said to me, "Gail, this is, I know exactly what's going on here because I've been through this before. My family lived through the communist takeover in China, and this is exactly what happened. The government came in, you know, created a false narrative of how, you know, society needed to, you know, give up their rights because the government was going to look after them for, you know, certain reasons A, B, and C. And then she watched her entire culture dissolve through the takeover of communism. And it's helped me kind of put things into perspective for us here in this country too, in that, you know, we don't as Americans know what communism and totalitarianism look like because we've had a free country since the inception of America. You know, if we don't look at those topics and try and really get down to the bottom of what's going on here, we're just going to potentially follow in the same footsteps as these other countries.